Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at prairies today with our guest, Neil DeBoe, back with us once again. He is president of Prairie Nursery, recognized international expert in native plant community ecology. In fact, he sometimes works around the world, as a matter of fact, on a consulting basis. Starting the show by talking about the results of fall versus spring seeding, but we'll also talk about seed collecting, creating a no-mow lawn, maybe taking your prairie garden questions as well. Maybe you collect prairie seeds. What's your favorite method? What would you like to know about establishing a prairie garden? Join in the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas at WPR.org. And Neil DeBoe, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
How are things at Prairie Nursery?
Things are surprisingly busy for August the 17th. People are really getting into native plants more and more. And I think not just because the plants are beautiful, low maintenance, but also because they offer such excellent opportunities to support pollinators, birds, butterflies. Yeah. And so you get more than just the plants. You get the whole concept of a plant community and the critters that depend upon them. And that's becoming increasingly important, and people are recognizing how important this is, and they're taking action and planting more natives.
Yeah, it's great. And it doesn't have to be acres and acres. It can be a very small little prairie garden like I've got.
It's amazing what a small prairie garden, even in an urban area, can do for supporting pollinators, butterflies, et cetera.
And whatever. You know, I mentioned at the start of the show we were going to talk about seeding fall. You know, there's fall seeding, there's spring seeding. Of course, we're heading into fall seeding. Probably some good news and bad news relating to that if you want to do some fall seeding.
Yeah, if you have a site that's ready and all the weeds have been eliminated and you've got bare ground, fall is an excellent time for seeding prairies. And it's interesting. You can take the exact same seed mix and the exact same site with the exact same site preparation and plant half in the fall and half in the spring. And you will end up 5, 10, 20 years later with completely different prairies. Because when you plant in the fall, it really helps to break seed dormancies in your wildflowers. And so you get higher germination of wildflowers when planted in the fall compared to planting in the spring. That's not to say that you can't plant prairies in the spring and have excellent results, but you'll have a higher proportion of wildflowers to grasses when you plant in the fall. And many of your warm season prairie grasses, like big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, side oats grama, perform at a lower level when planted in the fall, seeded in the fall, because something happens to that seed over the winter in the ground, and it is not favored by that, and you'll have reduced grass germination with a fall seeding. So in fall seedings, you get a higher percentage of flowers and a lower percentage of grasses than you would with a spring seeding.
Yeah. So, and probably a lot of people would like that.
It's amazing. It used to be that everybody planted their, most people planted their prairies in the spring. But then when people started figuring out, hey, you know, I really like the flowers a little bit more than the grasses, people now are planning to plant in the fall for that very reason. Also, when you look at site preparation, it usually occurs over a full year, depending on what you're killing, whether it's a lawn or an old field or an agricultural field. People often find that it takes all year to eliminate the weeds, and they're ready to seed in the fall. So as long as it's not, as long as it is not an erosion-prone site on a hill or somewhere where you might have problems keeping everything in place over the winter, fall seedings are really a very excellent option. On hillsides, you want to have it seeded usually by mid to late September with a nurse crop of either oats, annual rye, or something that will germinate that fall and hold that ground. Actually, we use a cover crop a little more than a nurse crop. Nurse crop would be an annual grass like oats or annual rye where you plant it at a low rate with a spring seeding to give a little cover for your seedlings. In the fall, you want more than just a little cover. You want something that's really going to hold that ground, so we use a higher rate of those annual grasses.
So do you put all those down at the same time?
Put everything down at the same time, absolutely.
Yeah, and when is it too late?
Well, it depends. If it's a flat level area, it's never too late. Well, if there's 3 feet of snow on the ground, it's not recommended. But as long as it's level and there's no chance of erosion, you can plant late into the season. And many people do that. There has been concerns about seeding too early in the fall and that maybe some prairie seeds would germinate and the little seedlings would get killed over the winter. I have never seen that personally. And these plants have been doing this for a long time. I think they know what they're doing. So the seeds are pretty smart in their own way about when to come up. So we've planted in August, September, October, November, December with good results.
What about transplanting? What plants do better when, you know, planted now and into the fall?
That's an excellent question, Larry. A lot of your early blooming woodland wildflowers, not so much prairie flowers or prairie grasses, but your early blooming woodland wildflowers like trilliums, bloodroot, Some of these very early emerging plants do better with a fall planting in September or October, and those plants are usually dormant by mid to late September. So the bulbs or the roots are ready to be transplanted safely after they go dormant in the fall. So those then will get some roots established in the fall. Even though the leaves are dormant, the roots will continue to grow after they're transplanted into the fall, giving them a head start for when they emerge in the spring.
And in terms of the timing on that, then, you can't go too late on transplants.
Well, actually, there are ways to do it.
Ah.
Yeah. Normally, we like to have plants in late September, mid to late September into October. But as long as it's not an erosion-prone site on a hillside, if it's relatively level, you can put plants in surprisingly late, but you must take very important precautions. So if I'm putting in plants in late October, November, I've planted trees as late as the first week in December, which is definitely not recommended. Okay. But you can take measures to prevent winter losses by basically covering those plants with a very thick layer of insulation. And I use clean, weed-free straw, like winter wheat straw.
Mm-hmm.
So if I plant a prairie garden late in the season, and even if I plant it in September or October, I will let the plants become established.
Yeah.
And then around Thanksgiving, I will go out and cover the entire area with 6 inches of clean straw, weed-free straw. It creates a beautiful blanket. Yeah. I make sure and I mark where every plant is with a little, you know, those little wire steel flags.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
You can use different colors, or you can just write a code name on it for the species. And I mark each plant before I put the mulch down. You put 6 inches of mulch over that, and it provides a perfect blanket so those plants are not exposed to extreme changes in temperature. It insulates them from the winter cold. You get really good results. And then in the spring, that 6 inches of mulch will usually get compressed down to about 2.
Yeah.
Well, voila, that's exactly what you would put on in spring. It's all taken care of. But you might have a little bit too thick mulch where each plant is, so you just go and pull the mulch away by each flag, a couple inches in diameter so the plants can emerge. The straw holds in moisture, so you don't have to water the plants, and it prevents germination of weeds because it's burying the weed seeds. So it's a really good method for planting late in the season, or if you're doing a fall seeding, if you're doing a fall transplanting, you allow the plants to become established in September, October, early November, and then mulch them in late November.
We've got some more questions for you, but so too do our listeners. Every one of our lines is filled right now, so I want to take some calls. Mary in Eau Claire has been waiting the longest, so let's go to Mary. Hi, Mary. Thanks for waiting.
good morning. I just wanted to share an experience. I just started a, 10 by 10, I call it my prairie patch.
Okay.
Mostly grasses. And I sowed it in the spring, and after clearing it off. And my gosh, the weeds came in. So they were so awful. Then I just tore out everything in the fall, every living plant. And seeded in a bunch of grasses again. And then the next spring, the weeds were coming back, and I was pretty exasperated. So I just pulled out the weeds, and I decided, well, we'll just have a patch of cosmos here. And figured it was a good prairie flower. The cosmos grew. I threw a whole package of cosmos seed on it. And, well, they formed a cosmos jungle. But when I cut them back, you know, in the fall, the prairie plants that I'd seeded in the previous fall had done just fine under the cosmos, and it had kept the weeds under control. And, well, that was 4 years ago. And
now you got a great little prairie there.
Yeah, that's great.
Mary, thanks for calling. Comments from you, Neil.
Well, I think that just points to the fact how tough some of these prairie plants are, and also points to the fact that these are perennials. Almost all of the prairie plants are perennials. There are a few biennials and an occasional annual that you might put in a prairie mix, but the vast majority of them are slow-growing perennials, and they may only grow as seedlings 1 to 6 inches tall the first year, so they may even be imperceptible to to someone who's not accustomed to knowing what prairie seedlings look like when they're 1 inch tall, which is kind of a very special art that very few of us possess. In fact, I was out this morning in the rain at a client's here in Madison, crawling around on the ground in the pouring rain looking for prairie seedlings that he seeded last fall. And he's got pretty good germination on a lot of species. And some are hard to tell because there are a lot of weeds in there. And so they're hiding in the weeds. And so you might not even know they're there, even to a trained eye. You can't always see them because there's so much other vegetation mixed in. But it does take usually about 3 years for most of your prairie flowers and grasses to reach maturity, and some may take 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Well, good for you, Mary, for sticking with it. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Bill in Pewaukee a chance to join in. Bill, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I've been struggling with my small prairie that's on top of my septic mound, and I've got it's about 50 by 150, and in the spring, it was wonderful and beautiful. I took a picture of my wife surrounded by all these flowers. Deer took to bedding down into it and squashed all the flowers down, and what has come up are Canada thistles. Now, I've had an infestation forever with those thistles, and now is the time that I just don't know what else to do. I cut off the flowers to keep them from spreading all those seeds. But beyond that, what can I do to knock those out?
Well, Bill, there's a reason why Canada thistle is a federal noxious weed.
Yeah.
It is very difficult to control. You have a couple of different options. The organic option is to pull the stems 5 times a year for about 5 years. And that will eventually exhaust the roots. You might get it in 3 years. But it's a really long-term process, and you have to keep after it and constantly pull it. Like every month, go out there and pull it, and then it regrows and pull it until you exhaust the roots. The other choice is to use a chemical control. There are two herbicides that are particularly effective on Canada thistle, aminopyrrolid and clopyrrolid. These are called Milestone and Stinger, respectively. There are many other names for them. And rather than go out and spray, we don't recommend that people go out and spray herbicides in their prairie because you have huge collateral damage. And you're putting a lot of chemicals in the environment. So what I do to control Canada thistle is I go out when it's in bloom or just in the bud stage, which is when it's recommended, and cut it to the ground. And then just put a few drops of concentrated herbicide of either the aminopyrrolid or clopyrrolid on the cut stem. And that will then translocate down into the root. You can do this after blooming as well. You don't want to do it before blooming because the energy of the plant is coming up and the herbicide will not be translocated down. So this method uses a minimum amount of herbicide. You're not spraying it, so it's not getting on all your other plants and other organisms. But it is rather time-consuming because you have to crawl around on the ground and cut each and every stem with your pruning shears and then put a just a few drops on each stem.
Yeah. There you go. Those are the two options, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Sandy in Waukesha next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, I took you off a speakerphone. I'm not sure if this is a prairie question, but I'm a beekeeper, so when I hear about all the chemicals, you know, I recoil. But in any case, the roadsides around my house are filled with white and yellow sweet clover. And even though I could go online and buy a pound for almost nothing, I've been picking the seeds off the plants and saving them. My questions are twofold. One is, you know, what about freezing them, keeping them over the winter and whatever? And what should I do to inoculate them before I plant them?
Okay, if I understand you, Sandy, you want to grow this wicked weed. Is that correct? I guess he's gone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time.
You bet. So sweet clover was brought to you courtesy of the United States Soil Conservation Service in the 1930s during the drought, and it was used as a forage because it has an extraordinarily high nitrogen fixation rate, and it makes good forage for cattle. It also, and this obviously many beekeepers will use it because it produces vast quantities of flowers, which then can produce honey. So in a prairie, these are some of our absolute worst weeds. But for you as a beekeeper, and this runs completely contrary to my whole training to actually grow this horrible stuff because we spend so much time eliminating it. If you plant the seed in the fall, it should germinate in the spring and do just fine. And I don't know about inoculating. It doesn't seem to need inoculation in nature. It grows like crazy all on its own. And I don't know if the rhizobium bacterium that it is associated with in the soil is naturally occurring in large volumes, in large quantities, so it just finds it. But you should have no problem growing these. They are extremely successful plants, generally considered to be weeds. So you should have no problem with that. They are biennials. So the first year you will not get blooms. You'll get just growth of maybe 6 to 18 inches of the leaf material. And in the second year, they can grow 5, 6, 7 feet tall, and that's when they will bloom, and then the plants will die. But they will produce copious quantities of seeds. And so all you have to do is maintain, just go in there and just lightly work the ground up to create a seed bed for them to germinate, and they will come back with a vengeance, I assure you. And interestingly, it's a biennial. Most biennials do not persist in a maturing meadow situation or prairie situation. Sweet clovers, both white and yellow sweet clovers, and Queen Anne's lace are two groups, or three species, white and yellow sweet clover and Queen Anne's lace, are three species that are able to, I believe, due to the nature of their tap roots, are able to persist in established prairies and established meadow situations. So just throw that seed out in the fall, and I bet you'll have plenty of good old sweet clover. Good luck.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBoll, our guest president, a prairie nursery and a consulting ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer today. Kate Archer-Kent, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network on Garden Talk. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network as we talk prairies with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions, number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you have some photos, email those photos along. We'll take a look and see what we can comment on. We have Kate in Menasha with something for us. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I hope this is the right program to ask this question. I walk in the country, and there are trails. Beside the trails, there are beautiful native plants, including milkweed, flowers, etc. And then about the end of July, start of August, the whatever municipalities or state organizations are maintaining those trails, I find that they mow beside the trails and mow down the mature milkweed and flowers and so forth. I wondered, is there any way to educate the state or the communities about the value of leaving those plants up? I mean, they mow like 6 feet beside each side of the trail. We don't really need that much clearance. And mm-hmm. It's a shame to lose all those plants. I just wondered if there's any effort or anything we can do to protect those.
There is quite a bit of educational work that gets done, isn't there, Neil?
Absolutely. And you can do citizen education.
Absolutely.
By going to your township or your county, whoever's in charge of the mowing. And I would just sit down with them on a positive educational basis and say, hey, I'd like to make a suggestion. And, you know, pollinators are important. The whole crisis with the monarch butterflies is a big deal. And I'd like to work with you to see if we can't optimize habitat and just adjust our mowing practices to favor these important members of our communities. And you may find that they're very open to this. And if you create a positive, encouraging educational format, I think that you'll have a good chance of maybe getting some adjustments. One of the issues we run into, especially in rural agricultural areas, is that roadsides, trail sides, etc., also harbor weeds. And a lot of weeds, like Canada thistle, or one of the big ones now is wild parsnip, which is spreading all over the place. These tend to mature in mid to late summer, and if you don't mow them before that, then you get all kinds of spread of these horrible invasive weeds, which then will knock out the wonderful native plants. So you're kind of in a management conundrum here unless somebody takes responsibility for these areas and goes in and controls individual weedy areas without harming the natives. So you have these conflicting priorities that occur here, but and you can also put up with the county or the town, put up signs, no mow areas, or mow later areas. One of the problems if you stop mowing altogether is the area will invariably become invaded by trees and shrubs, and you will lose whatever wildflowers and native grasses you had. So mowing is actually a very important management tool in maintaining native wildflowers. In fact, where I live in Marquette County, you can see on the mow lines, and usually they mow later in the season, although they've taken to mowing twice a year now, so they will come through in the summer, unfortunately. But the highest diversity of native prairie plants which remain on our roadsides are in the areas that are mowed. And behind that, they tend to be dominated by smooth brome grass or other species, and you have a significant reduction in diversity of native plants because of no mowing. And so the more dominant individual species will tend to take over with no mowing or similar disturbance.
Yeah, very interesting. Kate, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to John in Suring next. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, it's more of a comment of the way I plant things. I mean, I don't till the ground. I don't, you know, mow it. Don't do anything like that. But what I do is I modified a drone, and I take my milkweed and whatever wildflowers are out there. I'm going to float around, and then I run it up there, and whichever the wind's blowing, I release them.
That's amazing. This is a first. That is so cool.
That is, and you have success, John.
Oh, yes. I got milkweed everywhere this year. A couple of years ago, I lost 90% because it was so wet. I even lost some 20-year-old trees, but everything's working great. I'm picking up these little, I don't know what kind of flowers are. They're little orange and really golden orange, black, and some little white flowers. I picked them up, and I saw them up there, too, you know.
that's really something else.
Send us a photo of the drone. I'd love to see how you do that, John. Go to ideas@wpr.org and post a photo of that. Let's take a look. Or email us. Better yet, email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'd love to see how that works. It's pretty cool. First, a couple of firsts on this program.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You never know what you're going to learn on Garden Talk, including the guests.
let's go to Dean in Iron River. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I've got a question on what plants to put down for feeding the wildlife instead of putting in, like, brassicas and clover for the deer and the wildlife and that on my food plot.
Yeah.
Okay, Dean, a couple questions. Any specific types of wildlife that you want to attract?
Deer, grouse, turkeys, migrating birds, and whatever else coming through.
Okay. Your choice of grasses and flowers will depend upon the target species that you want to attract. For instance, deer are going to like a little denser, taller grass to bed down in where they get better cover. But if you're looking at, like, well, for instance, bobwhite quail, which most people have pretty much given up on, grouse, they like a little lower cover, so you would work with more shorter prairie grasses if that was your goal. If you're looking at supporting brooding birds, nesting birds, you want to make sure you put lots of prairie flowers in because the flowers attract the insects that form the main portion of the diet, both for the adults and for the chicks. And if you just plant prairie grasses, you'll get good cover, but it's like building a house without a kitchen because there's very little food that will be provided for the birds, and they are going to rely primarily on insects. Deer do not eat a lot of the prairie flowers. They don't eat the grasses at all. They'll eat some prairie flowers, as many of our customers have found, much to their dismay. But mostly the deer are going to use this area for cover and bedding and then go into the woods for acorns and the alfalfa field and the corn field and the bean field for the rest of their meals. So it really depends on what you're trying to attract. But the tall grasses, like big bluestem and Indian grass and switchgrass, are usually the three that you choose for dense nesting cover. Studies that I've read have shown that Indian grass and big bluestem are preferable to switchgrass for wild turkey for whatever reason. Those are just the studies I've seen. Switchgrass is widely planted for dense nesting cover, but you want to make sure that you break that monocultural stand up and put lots of flowers in there if you really want to have success with growing successful broods of birds.
There you go. Thanks, Dean. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about prairies today with our guest, Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. Bill and DePere, it's your turn.
Yeah, hey, guys. I kind of have like a Darwinian evolutionary question for you. Why? It seems like the toughest, most successful plant in everybody's garden is weeds. Why, when we came here, why isn't like every prairie out there pretty much 80% weeds? Why are there any natural, you know, beneficial plants that we like in general? And then I hate pulling weeds. It's not in my DNA, but I love gardening. I love animals. So any solution that you can give me so I can minimize spending hours pulling weeds would be very helpful.
Well, there are many definitions of weed. The general definition is a plant out of place. The ecological definition, generally speaking, is a plant that colonizes disturbed soil. And in most gardens, in the way Americans garden, is you have lots of disturbed soil. And when there's open soil, that's a vacuum that nature is waiting to fill. And she's probably not going to fill it with something nice because we brought all these wonderful weeds over from Europe and Asia. And we also had some wonderful weeds here before Europeans came here and started colonizing North America. So you have a history of all these different weeds from all over the world, plus people have gardens with open soil, so it's just it's a time bomb waiting to happen. So the trick is to minimize exposed soil where weeds can become established. And if you go to England and you go look at English gardens, yeah, there's a significant difference between the way the English garden and the way Americans garden. And Larry, you've been to
yeah,
okay, how much mulch do they use in their gardens? Did you see any mulch?
No.
And why is that?
Because they don't have any disturbed soil.
Because they fill it full of plants.
Yeah.
Okay, and they're using the plants to fight the weeds. So they're looking not only at what the plant flowers are, they're looking at the root systems, and they're looking at the actual foliage, and the foliage is going to shade out the weeds, and the root systems are going to compete with the weeds, and that's exactly what we do with the prairie. We include a wide variety of flowers and grasses, and the dense fibrous roots of the grasses in the prairie help to squeeze out the weeds. And many of the flowers have large spreading foliage, which also helps to shade out the weeds. So you can create a beautiful low-maintenance prairie garden by packing those plants in there. Now, in America, we tend to make these mulch gardens where we have little specimens kind of stranded out in this pile of wood chips. That's stupid. It's just stupid. It makes no sense. And where that ever came from, I don't know. It's completely unecological. And also, anybody who's used copious quantities of wood chips knows that they love to attract Canada thistle. Canada thistle seems to prefer growing in wood chips. So it's just like setting up yourself for failure. So you want to pack those plants in as closely as possible, but it requires a reorientation of what people think is an appropriate garden setting. So use the plants to fight the weeds. Don't have open soil. And get off the mulch treadmill.
There you go, Bill. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Good advice there when it comes to prairies and other types of gardens as well. Deborah in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to start a small prairie garden. It'll probably be about 10 by 15 feet. And I'm wondering if I can start preparing the soil this fall with like black plastic or cardboard or something, and then hopefully it'll be ready in the spring.
Well, Deborah,
what should I do?
Let me ask you a few questions. Number one, what is growing there now?
Mostly grass and weeds.
Mostly grass and weeds, like not lawn grass, but just weedy grasses.
Just like lawn grass and
other weeds.
Lawny weeds.
Okay, do you know what those lawny weeds are? Because this is going to be a very important determination of what you're
talking about. There's some plantain, there's like some crabgrass, quackgrass, that sort of thing, and some...
Quack?
I'm not sure. I can never tell the difference.
Okay. This is very important, and this is one of the things that when you're looking at what process to use, it's really important to know who you're up against, because you need to know the behavior of the individual weedy grasses, weedy weeds, in order to devise a plan that is going to work. And if you have quackgrass...
Hopefully there's no quackgrass in there.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, right. And there's no quackgrass in my yard either, Larry. Okay, good luck with that. So you have to know who the enemy is and what it's going to take to win the battle. So the first thing to do is to do an inventory of what the weeds are so you can determine how long it's going to take to smother them. And smothering is an excellent option on small areas, and it requires no chemicals. And one of the things you can do for smothering is to put down cardboard and then put down compost, weed-free compost, something that will add organic matter to the soil if it needs it. Okay, and that will help stabilize the cardboard, and it will also then help the cardboard decompose. However, if you have weeds like quackgrass, which is a rhizomatous perennial weedy grass, smothering it from August 17th through the end of this growing season and into next spring is probably not going to eliminate it. It's a tough customer. Other weeds that really resist smothering in a short period of time like that include things like Canada thistle, which is rhizomatous. It has a deep root. It can go up to 18, 20 inches deep. Crown vetch is a real problem. There are a number of others that are really problematic. Field bindweed, you might have to smother that for 2 or 3 years because the roots can survive that long. So you know who you're up against. But if it's just a lawn without quackgrass, like a bluegrass lawn, yeah, you could do that in 2 months and it'd be ready next spring. But it sounds like you have a little more complicated competitors in there. So normally we would recommend that you smother it for an entire year, starting in April, and smother it all the way through the fall. And then you could either put the plants in September, early October, or wait until the spring and put the plants in the spring. The advantage of planting in spring is that you have less chance of winter damage with the fall planting.
So she could start now for next fall.
She could, and it is possible that if she started now, she might be ready by late June of next year, because that will deprive the quackgrass of its fall and spring growing seasons.
Oh.
Okay, so if you're planting later in the season, if you're planting in April or May, probably not going to get that quackgrass killed off. But if you wait until end of June, you might be okay.
And then what could you put in June?
Oh, you could put in whatever.
Whatever you wanted.
Whatever you wanted. Yeah, potted plants, just we sell mostly 3-inch plants, but it's all roots, and you put those in and they come screaming out of the ground, and many of them will bloom the year they're planted. So
think in terms of not this fall, but probably maybe next June.
Late June. But you want to have at least, that'll deprive the quackgrass of 2 of its primary growing seasons, fall of 2018 and spring of 2019. It'll probably be pretty much knocked out by late June of next year.
Good luck, Deborah. You got a little work ahead of you right now, but there could be some great results come next year. Thank you very much for calling. And we turn to Doug in Waniwok next. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how you doing, Neil?
Good.
Hey, Doug.
Hey, my question is, I seem to have, I believe it's kudzu growing in my sister's back prairie, and it's matting down everything, and it's growing mile a minute. It seems like. And I was wondering if there's anything I do or if I've misidentified it.
I hope it's not kudzu.
Have you made a positive identification on this, Doug?
I've looked at it online, and it really does look like kudzu. And I did live in the South when I was in the military for a while, and it is the plant that ate the South.
Well, kudzu is moving north, so it's not out of the question. I have not heard of anybody having kudzu yet, but you know what? Its stuff is changing rapidly. Yeah. So, wow, kudzu, yikes. This is another legume.
This is the worst.
Yeah, and it just crawls all over everything. I have honestly never gone mano a mano against kudzu. So I have really no experience with it.
But you can identify. Can you take, Doug, have you got photos that you could email us?
Yes.
And it's crawling. It's a vine crawling all over everything. I mean, if you lived in the South, you know kudzu.
Right, yeah, it's gone. I mean, it's climbing up the trees and going across and manning down everything else.
Wow.
So, and I've looked it up online with the pictures and whatnot, and done my comparison with the DNR and whatnot. And
okay, have you talked to the DNR about it?
Very similar. Pardon me?
Have you talked to the DNR about it?
I have not.
Okay, I would suggest that if you get kudzu, I would suggest that you contact Kelly Kearns.
Yes.
At the Bureau of Endangered Resources in Madison. I'm sorry, I don't have her phone number memorized, but
Kelly Kearns, Kearns with a K. And
yes, K-E-L-L-Y-K-E-A-R-N-S. I'm sure if you Google Kelly Kearns, Wisconsin DNR, you'll get her email and her phone number. And she needs to know about this because she's Bureau of Endangered Resources and she's in charge of invasive plants.
Yeah, she's often on this program. And it's I really encourage you to do that today, Doug, if you wouldn't mind. Get a note to her because they're going to want to know that for sure. There are some other climbing weeds that are out there right now you see along the roadsides now.
Yeah. And I'm sure Kelly will be able to give you some insight on how to control it because she's up on all that stuff. That's her job. She knows her stuff.
Yeah, and when you write her, I maybe attach a couple of photos. That would be very, very good thing to help her realize that, hey, this is really kudzu. Doug, can you do that?
I can.
Wonderful.
All right. Please do it. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, I was hoping I'd never have to talk about kudzu on this program.
You want to hear a funny story? Do we have time for a funny story? When I was working my way through college, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, I worked on riverboats on the Mississippi River, Ohio River, Illinois River as a deckhand. And we were heading north from New Orleans, and we were in Mississippi, and it was middle of the night, and the fog came in, and we had to tie off our tow. 54 barges, and my job was to go down the ladder into the mud, into the woods, just nudge up against the bank, and this is flood stage, it was in spring, and find the biggest tree and tie this big rope around it, and then we would just kind of drift back into the current, and that would hold 54 barges and a boat, which is like, I can't tell you how many thousands and thousands of tons that is. So it's the middle of the night. I'm out there with a flashlight trying to find the biggest tree. Wrapped the rope around this biggest tree, covered in vines, but it was a big tree. And we all went back to the boat, and a couple hours later, all hands on deck, we had broken free from this tree. And we're running in the fog, but we made it okay. We hauled this tree out. It was still hooked to the rope. And this giant tree was all kudzu, and it was about a 12-inch diameter tree. What looked like a 36-inch diameter tree, it was dead. You couldn't tell. It was a dead tree covered in kudzu, so obviously that did not hold 54 barges. So that was an interesting kudzu experience.
Oh, on that note, let me remind you that Neil DeBall is our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery. Always great to have Neil come by as we talk prairies with him. And we've talked a bit about seeding, when to do it, and what works best when you do it in the fall, what works good when you do it in the spring. And every line is filled, so we'll go to the phones now. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Hart in Baraboo up next. Hart, thanks for calling.
Larry, great show. Question I have for your guest is, I have about 2 acres of woods, and I'm in the process of eradicating buckthorn. And I've got cut down about 125 trees. I've got another 300 to go. So I'll have partially shade, mostly oaks and hickory. Any recommendations in terms of what I could sow on the floor of what I have, the small forest I have?
Okay.
Hart, I got a couple questions for you, if you're still there. What would be the maximum height that you would be comfortable with?
Well, it would vary. I think there's probably some areas I'd be comfortable with 2 or 3 feet, and some other areas I'd probably want to keep it about a foot or 6 inches to a foot.
Okay, that pretty much knocks out most of our native woodland grasses. Because if you're working with some of the more common native grasses like Virginia wild rye or bottle brush grass, these get about 5 feet tall, so they may not be acceptable. That's why I wanted to make sure and ask your height requirements.
Wonderful. Is that the bright, kind of bright purple, reddish color?
No, these are pretty much straw-colored grasses in the fall. There are a couple other lower-growing woodland grasses like Diarrhina americana, and I can't for the life of me remember the common beak grass, B-E-A-K grass. And there are some wonderful sedges, and I would suggest you look into sedges. The sedges tend to be a little more expensive than the grasses, but their seeds are smaller, so even though the unit price per pound is higher, you don't need as much seed. So there are some wonderful sedges, woodland sedges like Carex sprengelii. Gosh, I'm really bad with the common names. There are a whole bunch of them. So if you want, you can email me, and I could be happy to put together a custom mix for you. But there are many woodland sedges that are really pretty decent, and a lot of people are using these after they cut down the buckthorn or other invasive species like honeysuckle. Then they are seeding these in. Now, one of the things you want to be cognizant of is after you take down your buckthorn, I assume that you're cutting the stumps to kill the roots. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm cutting the roots. I leave about a 6-inch stump, and I'm doing the plastic bag.
Oh, the buckthorn baggie. Okay.
Yeah, because I'm on well water, and I don't want to contaminate my well.
Got it. Okay, so you're going to do the buckthorn baggie, which basically smothers the resprouts on the stem. And for people who are not aware of this, you can just Google buckthorn baggie. And they're basically plastic garbage bags, heavy-duty plastic garbage bags that you wrap around the cut stem. And then it exhausts the plant's root system as it tries to resprout. It shades out the resprouts, killing the plant eventually. So you want to make sure that you've got all of your buckthorn killed, whether you're using the buckthorn baggie or if you're cutting and treating the stump with an herbicide. Then you're going to have a big flush of buckthorn seeds, dormant seeds that will come up next spring. And the amazing thing about buckthorn, it will germinate between April and October. Yes, it will germinate in October. It's indefatigable. So you'll have a year of maximum germination of dormant seeds. And the second year after cutting, you still will have a few remnant buckthorn seedlings that will come up. So you may want to spend some time controlling those. However, and this is not going to work for you, but some of our customers will put down a native grass or a native sedge mix or a combination of native grasses and sedges, and because these are monocots and buckthorn is a dicot, they can use broadleaf herbicides to kill any buckthorn seedlings or other undesirable broadleaf dicotyledonous plants, weeds, etc., trees, etc., that come up. Now, that presupposes that you're not putting in any flowers in your mix because it will kill that, and you may not want to use broadleaf herbicides. But you want to make sure you've got control over that seeding environment, especially if you don't have the option of using herbicides. You're going to want to make sure you have controlled those buckthorn seedlings that are inevitably going to come up next spring. So you may want to spend next year figuring out a strategy for controlling those seedlings prior to putting down your seed. And the best time to seed a native sedge mix is in the fall, because the seed dormancies are overcome by spending the winter in the soil, as opposed to a spring seeding where that does not occur, and you'll have much lower germination. You'll have mostly weedy growth the first year and very little sedge growth with a spring or early summer seeding, whereas in the fall, sedges are much higher germination the next spring.
Oh, there we go. You mentioned you could put together a mixture for him, yeah, sort of for him individually. Do you do that very often?
Well, most people will purchase our pre-designed prairie seed mixes in our catalog or on our website.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have pre-designed gardens, and it comes with a template. So it's like, here's a 32-plant garden or a 64-plant garden or a 96-plant garden. And then people just look at the template and put in their plants. Voila, done. So you don't have to sit there and do all the design work. So most of our customers will order the pre-designed seed mixes or gardens, but oftentimes for larger areas, I'll do a custom garden design for specific situations, specific soils, or just a client wants certain species. And then, yes, we do put together a specific sedge mix for woodlands. And I think we're going to be offering that on our website starting this, probably next spring.
Yeah. What's your website again?
It's www.prairienursery.com. PRAIRIENURSERY, Prairie Nursery. You can just put Prairie Nursery into Google and it'll come right up. And we do have a catalog, too, that we will send to people that would prefer to read a catalog.
And there's a beautiful catalog, by the way. I have it right in front of me right now, the Native Plant Catalog, an ecological gardening guide. So lots of good information in there. Hart, you got a little work ahead of you there. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kristen in Sauk City, it's your turn.
Hi. So I am totally new to prairie grass, and I'm just wondering what resources, like where does one begin when they're looking to kind of put in to fill a rather large space with prairie grass and just a prairie garden? if you will.
Sure, like prairie grasses and maybe some prairie flowers as well, Kristen?
I would love that.
Sure.
But I'm totally new to where to even begin.
Well, you can go to our website, and there's a ton of information on that website. And if you drill down, I would first and foremost look at resources and guides on the Prairie Nursery website, and there's all sorts of information. And then if you have insomnia, you can go to my page, and there are zillions of articles on there, pretty technical articles, but they're very helpful. And if you go to the site and look under on the far right side, it says Prairie Nursery on the little green bar. Click on Prairie Nursery, and it will come down to my name, Neil Duvall, and then there's a whole list of all sorts of articles for those fond of sleeping. No, I'm kidding. There's some good information in there. So I would start with that. But most importantly, you want to design this to fit your space. And you said it's in your front yard. So I would strongly suggest if you're in a residential area. Is that the case?
Is that the case?
Nope. Nope. We're rural.
Okay, so you don't have to worry about the neighbors?
Nope.
Okay, it's a large area?
Yeah.
Okay, then you're going to want to use seeds, because to put in plants would be cost prohibitive unless you're, you know, sitting on a big pile of money that you want to send to Prairie Nursery. We'd love that, of course. But it's much more cost effective. If you're dealing with more than a few hundred square feet, you're probably going to want to use seeds. Our seed mixes are for 1,000 square feet and larger, or wherever you decide to get your products from. Seeds are much, much cheaper, because if you look, the average plant's going to cost you $3-4. And you put one plant per square foot. So that's, say, $4 a square foot. So you have 1,000 square feet. That's $4,000 plus your labor. You can get a seed mix for $75 to cover 1,000 square feet. So it's orders of magnitude difference. So from a purely budgetary standpoint, seeds are probably going to be the way to go. But the most important thing I can share with you is, number one, make sure you completely get any weeds, grasses, et cetera, completely killed and eliminated before you put seeds or plants in. And number two, make sure you select the seed mix or the plants to match your soil and moisture conditions and your sunlight conditions. Super important.
So a soil test might be a starting point, too.
You know, Larry, that's a really good point. Soil tests are really important. Normally, if you have anything approaching a normal, reasonable loamy soil, silt loam soil, sandy loam, clay loam, very seldom in Wisconsin will you have any problems with nutrient deficiencies. But when you get into like these really dry, sandy soils, which have low organic matter, you will oftentimes find you can have a lot of issues with low calcium, low magnesium, low potassium, low phosphorus. Nitrogen is not usually a big factor. Many of these plants are able to grow under low nitrogen conditions. But if you have a dry, sandy soil, we recommend that you test your soil just to make sure that you don't need to add something there to ensure better growth of your plants.
Yeah, Kristen's in the Sauk City area. The soil shouldn't be too bad, but you never know. Individual.
A lot of sandy soils over there. Sandy loam. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
So it does depend. It can be variable. Yeah. But this is for like really dry, lousy soil. If you have sandy loam, my gosh, that's a pretty good soil.
Yeah, that's a pretty good soil. Kristen, does this help?
This is great. Yeah, it definitely points me in a direction. So.
Okay. And, you know, feel free to give us a call. You can call us if you want. Our toll-free number is 1-800-476-9453. And our mantra is that we sell three products at Prairie Nursery: plants, seeds, and information. And the information is usually free. So,
what's the? It was
1-800-476-9453.
9453.
1-800-GROW-WILD. I hate people when they put the letters on there. What's the number for that? So that's why I don't use that. But when 800 numbers became popular, I said, I got to get Grow Wild. And I had to wait and wait and wait. And on the day it came available, I called and got that number. And we never use it.
Never use it. Kristen, there you go. Thanks for calling. Oh, man. Bill in Madison, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, Larry. I got two quick questions. I have an unheated greenhouse. And I wonder if I could take those sedge seeds and sow them in flats this fall and then, you know, prick them out and grow them on next spring. And is there any benefit to buying your bare root flowers and potting them up and letting them grow this fall in pots and then overwintering in the cold greenhouse?
Okay, first question. Seeding sedge seeds and putting them in flats and letting them overwinter. That's a great way to break dormancy in the seeds. The only problem with that is you want to make sure you protect them from rodents and other critters, because we've used this method. And if you don't secure those flats, all sorts of guys are going to get in there and rip it up. Mice and things like that will rip up your seeds in the actual flat. Another option is to, and this is how we do this, is we actually seed the flats 30 to 60 days before, depending on the species, before we're going to grow them, and we put them in a big walk-in cooler that we built specifically for this.
Hmm.
And so we seed the flats, and then we put plastic saran wrap over the top, and then we put those, and we stack them up. Then we put little layers of cardboard between each one just for support, and we stack those up 5, 6, 7 feet high and put them on shelves in a cooler, a walk-in cooler that we keep at like 36 degrees. And that is a what they call moist stratification, which mimics the effects of winter on the seed and thus breaks seed dormancy. Some species need 7 days, some need 30 days, some need 60 days, some need 90 days, some need forever. So there's a couple. Irises are particularly difficult.
Is that right?
Yes, they are really, really a pain. And the best way to grow iris is just to throw them in a big pile of mud in the fall and let them do their thing and not even try and grow them in a pot.
Bill, does that help out?
Sure, but how about the
yes.
forbs?
Yeah.
The bare roots. If you pot up the bare root now, they're not going to. They'll do very little, if any, growth. You might get a little bit of root growth, but because they're going to be dormant by the time we ship them to you, you're not going to actually get any leaf growth on them. That's not to say that you can't do that, but if you're storing them outside, you run the risk of loss, winter loss in a pot because the cold is going to penetrate in through that pot. So unless you have them in a protected location where it's not going to go below 20 degrees Fahrenheit, I wouldn't use that method. Or unless you have some way to insulate them from cold weather, I wouldn't do that because you could have significant winter losses in the pots when it gets cold.
All right.
So I'd wait till spring.
That help out, Bill?
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet. Good luck.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBole, our guest today. He is president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist as well. He is the business, Prairie Nursery. PrairieNursery.com, isn't it?
PrairieNursery.com. Yes, lots of information on there.
And the phone number is 1-800-476-9453. Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at prairies today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest Neil DeBole, back with us, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist. Does a lot of great work, and he's happy to answer your questions. And maybe you have some about prairie gardening, looking for plant recommendations, problems, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Barb in Roberts has been waiting a bit here. Barb, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you, Neil. And thank you, Larry. I appreciate this. We have a remnant prairie, and I've got water hemlock in it. And I don't know whether I should really work at eradicating it, or is it aggressive, is it invasive, or do I let it just kind of be? I guess that's what I'm wondering.
Well, water hemlock, as you know, is a highly toxic plant. And it is generally not terribly aggressive. It also has a relative that occurs in our wet mesic and wet prairies called cowbane, Oxypolis rigidior, also named cowbane because it's not good for you. You don't want to be eating these things. And a single mouthful of water hemlock root can kill you. So,
wow.
Yeah, super toxic. One of the most toxic plants. It's like right up there with a death angel mushroom. So, but it does not generally perform in such a way that it's invasive. So it usually kind of has its little places in a wet prairie and just kind of hangs out and does its thing. So I've never seen it being invasive, but it's not something you want to mess around with. That's for sure. Highly toxic.
Is it something you'd get rid of?
Well, if I had kids, I'd get rid of it.
Yeah.
And if I had, you know, dogs or something that might go out there and eat it, yeah, I'd be very concerned about it. But it's just doing its thing, not bothering anybody. But if you bother it, you're in big, big trouble.
Oh, there you go, Barb. Thanks very much for calling. Paul in Sheboygan County has something for us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
My question is just, could you tell the difference, tell me the difference between quack grass and crab grass, and is there ever an appropriate place for either of these two plants?
Paul, you bring up an excellent question because I can't tell you how often people get these two confused. Quack grass is a cool season perennial grass that creeps by underground rhizomes that seldom exceed 4 inches in depth, and it can form a near solid mat of white rhizomes that are usually about a 16th of an inch in diameter. And if you pull up a quack grass or dig it up, you will find these white rhizomes. It is very distinctive. There are very few other grasses that will look like this. Very easy to identify. Crabgrass, on the other hand, is a warm season annual, and it germinates in May and June, even into July, in disturbed soil. And it is very prolific in lawns that have been damaged, or if you've had drought, or there's opening of soil. That's where annuals like to germinate. So crabgrass becomes problematic, often in very dry, sandy soils as well. But it will grow in almost any type of soil where there's an opening. But again, it doesn't germinate until later in the season. That is why people put down in their lawns, they put down a crabgrass preventer, usually in early May, just before those seeds start to germinate. Of course, a crabgrass preventer prevents germination of just about all seeds. But crabgrass is the one that people are often worried about. If you have established quackgrass, which is a perennial, you can put down all the crabgrass preventer you want, but it's not going to do a thing because it's already there. So quackgrass is very difficult to eliminate because of these rhizomes, and some people will go and plow it and turn it over, and it just comes right back up. You can go out and cultivate it and just chop up the rhizomes and make more of it, and it comes right back up. There used to be a machine, which I actually used because I did things organically 35 years ago. There's something called a quack digger. And if you're over 70, you might know what a quack digger is. And it is a series of cultivators on an erratic gear that actually rotates, and the cultivators go up and down and lift the quack grass rhizomes out of the ground to the surface of the soil where they dry out and die. And you have to do this all summer long with a quack grass, with a quack digger, and it will eliminate quackgrass. Of course, you're bringing up 80 gazillion new weed seeds every time you cultivate, but it will get rid of the quackgrass. So that's the difference between these two. Cool season perennial, quackgrass. Warm season annual, crabgrass, that generally germinates in May and June when the soil is warm.
There you go. Does that help out, Paul?
Well, it does. I have the quackgrass in my gravel driveway, and it, in my view, it seems to hold the gravel a little, you know, better than just having nothing growing there in the gravel. So
absolutely
wondering, is there any place where either one of these plants is actually useful other than in my situation with a gravel driveway?
Sure. And in fact, a neighbor of mine in Western Columbia County, his great-great uncle went back to Scotland in 1847 to bring back seeds of evergrass. And guess what evergrass was?
Quackgrass.
Quackgrass. And it was, they planted it for forage because it's in the spring, it's highly nutritious. You get 14, 15, 18% protein out of it. You can't kill it. And it grows pretty prolifically. So it can be used as a forage. In fact, there are people in Wisconsin, farmers in Wisconsin, who use quackgrass as part of their forage program for grazing beef cattle. And so they'll use it in their spring and their fall pastures. So it's not all bad. It's just that it creeps all over the place, and if you want another crop to grow, it's really problematic. But if you can figure out how to harness it for stabilizing gravel, stabilizing dry sand,
yeah.
Hey, at our nursery, well, we do excavations, we hope the quackgrass comes back.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's going to stabilize that lousy, rotten sand, and rather go spend money to put seed out there that may or may not grow, like a turf grass. Hey, quackgrass, bring it on. It's great. So we just did some major excavations for new greenhouses, and the quackgrass is moving in quite smartly, thank you very much, and we're very pleased for it. So it's not necessarily always bad. It's contextual in its goodness or badness.
There you go, Paul. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate that question. And Mark in Green Bay will turn to you next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. So first of all, Neil, I'd like to thank you for some advice you gave me a couple of years ago about propagating cardinal flowers. We didn't have any luck getting them started in flats, but the seed that I broadcast on the southern end of our garden that occasionally floods and is wet worked out. We got maybe 15 plants now. Unfortunately, they didn't come up where I wanted them to, and I need to transplant them. I'm wondering about what advice you can give me.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions, Mark. How long have the cardinal flowers been growing there?
One plant has been flowering for 2 years. The other has just started flowering this year.
Okay, the plant that's flowering for 2 years, this is probably its last year because cardinal flower is a short-lived perennial. It usually only lives 3 years. And I can't tell you how many of our customers call up and say, oh my God, I killed my cardinal flowers. And we say, no, if it's 3 years old, you didn't kill it. It probably committed suicide because they are short-lived perennials and they just end their cycle, their life cycle, usually after 3 years. So if you're going to transplant a cardinal flower, you want to transplant a one-year-old or a two-year-old plant. But here's another little trick. If you have a well-developed plant in a second year, you can actually divide it.
Oh.
Okay, so you can very carefully go and tease apart the clump and get three, four, five different plants out of it. You probably want to cut some of the leaves back if you're disturbing it while it's growing. But you can actually divide the cardinal flower and transplant it and put it in a wet area and keep it damp, and it'll be just fine. And it's really a streamside weed from the standpoint of weed, meaning a plant that colonizes disturbed soil. If you look at its natural habitat, it grows along semi-shaded streams where you have open silt. And when the seed pods are ripe, these little bitty seeds bob up and down on the water. They kind of lean over into the water, and they bob in the water, and then the seeds go down the stream, and then they get lodged in the new fresh silt, and they germinate in the open soil. They will not grow in a sod. They need open soil, just like most weeds. So it's short-lived, just like weeds. Most annual weeds or biennial weeds are short-lived perennials. So if you're going to move them, you're going to want to move them when they're 1 year old, preferably, or you could take a two-year-old plant and divide it and then thus extend the life of that plant by creating new plants that will then live another couple of years and bloom profusely.
Yeah. Mark, that help out?
At what time of the year would you do the division?
Well, it's pretty hard to kill cardinal flower. Normally, we would divide plants when they're dormant, which would be late fall or spring. The best thing you can do, if I was doing this, I would wait till spring, mark the plants, and when they just start to green up and you can find them, dig them up and divide them when the leaves are just starting to emerge. That is the safest and best time to do that.
There you go. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate the call. And let's see. We've got Doug in New Holstein next. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Two questions. One is I have a bunch of wild parsnip growing. This stuff, I'm in northeast Wisconsin. Never saw it for years and years. We've been on this piece of property, 11 acres, for about 15. And in the last 2 years, the stuff is everywhere. I don't want to use any herbicides. If I can help it, I understand I can't even burn this stuff away, and I'm wondering if I can soak it out with some other kind of planting.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
When I said that sweet clovers and wild carrot or Queen Anne's lace are biennials that can maintain themselves in a well-developed sod of perennial vegetation, I should have also added wild parsnip to that group. And wild parsnip is a biennial, which gives you the opportunity to control it by preventing it from making seeds, because it relies upon production of seeds and thus reinfestation of the area on a regular basis. So here's what I do with wild parsnip, and this is what you can use for controlling pretty much all biennials, which includes garlic mustard, sweet clovers, Queen Anne's lace, bull thistle. Most biennials, if you wait until they just finish blooming, and then you can cut them down to the ground, and that does it. And you don't necessarily have to cut them to the ground, but that's more effective. If you have other beneficial vegetation in the area, then you can just snip them with a pruning shears or something halfway down. But you want to make sure that you prevent the seeds from forming and maturing. So if you cut them before they bloom or during bloom, they will reflower. And you have to go back again, and it's a complete waste of time. This is true of almost all biennials. Queen Anne's lace is particularly vexing because you can cut it. It's indeterminate in its bloom. So it blooms for an extended period of time. So by the time you're cutting the ones that are ripening, there's new ones blooming. So that's more difficult. However, wild parsnip tends to be more determinate. Most of the flowers will bloom and seed at the same time. Another option is to wait until the seeds are forming and then just go and cut them off, put them in a plastic bag or something, and get them the heck out of there. Burn them or get rid of them. Get them off the property.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Doug. Appreciate the call. Bob in Crivitz, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello. This is Bob. Okay, I bought, this is the second year, butterfly weed from your people, and they all died last year. Okay, and showy milkweed, and they all died, and smooth, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly,
Penicillin.
Okay. And I called in late this fall, last fall, and they said I overly loved them because I watered them too much. Okay, so I replanted. I put in another order, and I've got them all planted. Okay, and this year I watered them, like you said, just went to get them started.
I've got two milkweed plants that are making it, and let's see, the showy milkweeds, I got two plants that are just barely above ground. Am I doing something wrong here, or should I just forget about this?
Wow, this is tough, Bob. What is your soil type?
I don't understand you. I'm sorry.
Okay, what kind of soil do you have? Is it a dry sand?
I have sand soil, and I've got maybe about an inch or two of topsoil.
Okay, well,
I've left the crivets about 20 miles.
Okay. Well, you would expect butterfly weed and showy milkweed to grow in drier sandy soils. Then the smooth penstemon, although it doesn't do best in dry sandy soils, if you're watering it a modest amount, it should have at least survived. So I'm not really sure what's going on, but here's what you can do. You can call me. Oh, boy, I'm going on vacation next week. But I'd be more than happy to help you try and figure this out, but it's kind of vexing here. That's strange that you would have this much difficulty twice in a row. Now, have you tested your soil by chance?
The other thing I was going to ask you were talking about covering them for the winter with a light amount of straw. Would that be a good idea, or would it be a poor idea?
Well, are you planting these in the fall or in the spring? I think you said you put them in the spring. Is that correct, Bob?
I put them in spring, right.
Yeah, so they should be well established by the end of the season. So then you would not have to cover the plants over the fall, so over the winter. So this is not sounding good. Here's what I suggest you do as a first step, and then why don't you contact me in late August, early September, and we'll see if we can't work this out and figure out what's going on. But you can get your soil tested at the state lab in Marshfield. And if you just Google Wisconsin University
soil plant and soil
forage forage and plant.
Forage and plant, that's it.
Thank you. Soil Forage and Plant Lab in Marshfield, Wisconsin. And they have a form there. If you can find their form, it's kind of hard to find it. Or, you know, I can send you the form, too, if you contact me and get you in touch with them. But they do, for $20-something bucks, they'll test your pH, your organic matter, your phosphorus, your potassium, your calcium, and your magnesium. These are the most important.
And you tell them what you're trying to do with that soil. That helps too.
Yes, they have a list of different options. Do you want to grow turf? Is it a vegetable garden? Is it a prairie garden? Blueberries, whatever you want to grow, then they will give you recommendations for what to do with your soil. So I'm really sorry you've been having problems here, but let's see if we can't work something out here and get you on the right track here. And maybe if these plants aren't working, let's see if we can't replace them with something else you might have a better chance of having success with, if that would be acceptable to you.
Yeah, that sounds great. So, Bob, you can go to, the number is 800-476-9453 or prairienursery.com online, and you can get a hold of Neil. Thanks a lot for calling. Steve in De Pere, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Gentlemen, good morning. I have what I'm assuming is an invasive species. It's a vine, grows along the ground, but it will climb, get up into shrubs and trees. And every so often, it puts down a root from the vine and sends up a stalk with five, sometimes six, large oval-shaped green leaves. And it's very, very aggressive.
And it turns red in the fall.
That I don't know. Okay. That I don't know. I just saw it a couple of months ago, and I've been pulling like crazy.
Okay, yeah, and if you pull it, you'll find there's a root just below the soil surface, correct? It runs laterally.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to bet you 99% you've got Virginia creeper.
Yeah.
Parthenocissus quinquefolia. And this is a native vine, and I'll tell you what, it can be really aggressive, but you know what? We use it for stabilizing steep slopes, where you can't plant anything else, and it will creep down that slope or creep up that slope, and it's great for stabilizing super steep slopes. But, yeah, I pull it out of my garden. I pull it out of my lawn. I try not to use chemicals, and so I'm out there digging it out of my lawn.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy, is it. It's like Sisyphus rolling the rock up the hill. But I get it. You got to go after it. So that is, I will bet you, look under Virginia creeper, and that's probably what you've got. And to control that, you can just take a dandelion digger and dig the rhizomes. I just pull them, then they break off, and then you got to find them again and pull them again and get the dandelion digger under there and pull them again and rip your lawn to shreds. It's really great. Other people will go in there with a broadleaf herbicide for killing a brush killing herbicide because it is a vine. You can spray them if you so desire. That's another option. But that's really about the only two ways I know to control that, either pull them out or spray them. But, yeah, it's a pretty tough customer, and it'll climb up trees. It'll crawl on your lawn. It'll go everywhere.
There you go, Steve. Thanks for calling. Doug in Abrams, it's your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I have a vine that's just similar to his, but I notice it. I drive between Green Bay and Milwaukee and anywhere throughout Wisconsin. Along the ditches or along a fence line, it's, I believe, a five-pointed vine or the leaf. And then at this time of year, this white flower is coming. So you can just see it. It's overtaking fence lines, and it'll climb trees any size. And does it ring a bell yet? Did I describe enough?
Doug, I'm surprised it took this long for someone to call about this plant. Yes, you have wild cucumber, which is a native annual. Very unusual. Most of our native plants are perennials, some biennials, but this is one of our native annuals, and it is an opportunistic plant. And because it's an annual, it needs open soil in which to germinate and grow. And it is doing phenomenally this year.
Yeah.
I was talking with one of my associates in my office yesterday, and we're trying to figure out why it's so abundant, and she thought it was because we had some cold weather without any snow cover last year, which might have damaged perennial cover of perennial plants, opening up the soil. Because remember, it got really cold in December?
Yeah.
And so that could have potentially damaged some of the perennial plants that otherwise would colonize that ground and thus created some openings where those dormant seeds can germinate. We had a huge flush in 2013 after the drought of 2012, which knocked back a lot of the perennial vegetation that occurs along roadsides and other places. So it's a native annual. It's going to be abundant this year. It'll then go into remission until the conditions are such that favor the germination of annual seeds again. And whatever disturbance occurs in nature that causes that, that's when it shines. So it's this very cyclic plant. Just takes advantage of the situation as they have come about. And the seeds sit in the ground. They look like watermelon seeds. Yeah. And if you look, if you take the cucumber, and they're going to be green, okay, and then they turn white and lacy. And a friend of mine in college taught me this. She said, take out the outer husk, and you'll see inside there's two capsule-like lacy containers that look just like a woman's girdle. Like, wow, is that ever cool? Well, who wears girdles anymore? But it's amazing, the resemblance here. And so that's just one little fun little thing to know about plants. So if you're a plant nerd, you know, you're always dissecting and looking and doing stuff. But that's wild cucumber, native annual, and really it's actually pretty beautiful.
Yeah, it's – my daughter was asking about that. I can tell you between on Interstate 94 between Madison and Lake Mills, at least, there is a lot of it. My daughter was like, what is that?
Yep.
Wild cucumber, I'm pretty sure.
It's a banner year for those wild cucumbers.
Oh, man. Well, Ron and Crandon, hi.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I heard you talking about the parsnip management, and I thought it'd be worthwhile bringing up the photophytodermatitis issue that can be along with that. I hope it wasn't mentioned earlier in the show, but again, I thought it's kind of nasty. I thought that was worth bringing up.
Ron, that's a really good point, and I was negligent not to mention that, because wild parsnip, as you pointed out, is phytotoxic, and if you get the sap on your skin anywhere, arms, legs, face, anywhere in the sun, it will be just like poison ivy. It's horrible. In fact, a friend of mine did not know what it was, and she walked through a field of it in her short pants, and she has welts to show for it 20 years later.
Oh,
scars
boy.
From that horrible plant. So if you're working with us, and I really should have said this, make sure that you wear gloves.
Yeah.
Do not
and long pants.
And long pants. Do not go in there and get any of that sap. And you really should have long sleeves on, too. Do not get any of that sap on you. And then go, no matter what, go and wash off.
Yeah,
right away.
Go and wash off right away. And on that happy note, Neil, thank you so much. This has been lots of fun, and you'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
Larry, it's always great to be Garden Talk. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you and have so much fun with all your wonderful listeners. Thank you.
Neil DeBull is president of Prairie Nursery. He's a consulting ecologist. Go online to his website at prairienursery.com. You'll find out all kinds of things about the nursery and the seeds and plants that they have. Great to have him with us, and he will be back. Monday, we'll talk to our regular physical therapist about preventing ACL injuries, so I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and please stay with us. There's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.